This is a production of the Pardes Institute of Jewish Studies. For more original Torah content, visit elmad.pardes.org.
Okay, good morning. Very exciting to be here on the Yom Iyun Shel Pesach. What I'd like to talk about today is the centrality of women in the story of Pesach. And what I'd like to suggest, and really my thesis, is that women are included in more mitzvot on Pesach than any other time of the year. And I would like to suggest it comes from the rabbinic approach to women in the Exodus story. Okay, so what we're going to look at really are two sets of sources. We're going to look at halachic sources in the Talmud, and we're going to look at agadic sources in the Talmud. And I'm going to suggest that I think the very positive attitude Chazal had towards women around the story of Exodus led them to deliberately include women in positive time-bound mitzvot from which they should be exempt. Okay, so that's really my thesis that we're going to explore in the next hour or so, a little over an hour. I'll say that we talk about the four sons, but what about the daughters? Meaning the midrash of the four sons, just as a little bit of an explanation, is not because the rabbis were excluding or eliminating women from this conversation, but largely because there's a very old midrash that appears in the Mechilta about four sons. Meaning it did not wake up one day and suddenly in the Haggadah four sons emerge and let's call them the wise, the wicked, the simple, or the stupid, and the child who cannot ask a question. It's largely because in the Torah there are four instances in which the passage tells us when your son asks you or when you tell your son. And the Midrashic author, the imagination of the Midrashic author over 2,000 years ago, set up a model by which there are four sons, four different types of children, who ask four different types of questions. And how would you answer those questions? It's really a Midrash that has nothing to do with Pesach, but it gets brought into the Haggadah because it really exemplifies what the Seder is about. It's about engaging children. It's about creating memory. A template for memory, a template for passing on memory. And so engaging the children or having the children enter that space in which parents and children ask and answer questions is going to be the phenomenal way in which we transmit the power of this particular memory, which is, of course, the beginning of our narrative as a people. And so the four sons, I would argue, yes, obviously represents a certain sexism, a bias towards the son rather than the daughter. But I think it's equally correct to do what we do today, to talk about the four children and different types of children, or maybe one child who through his life asks different kinds of questions. If you open any Haggadah, almost every Haggadah has a picture of the four different models of children. In the Schechter Haggadah in particular, David Golinkin has collected hundreds of Haggadahs, and there's a section in which there are about 30 or 40 pages of different Haggadahs from about 1500 CE until today. And it's quite fascinating to see the evolution, how the wise child is depicted, how the wicked child is depicted. All sons, of course, until recently when some artists decided to do daughters. But really, what I want to talk about tonight is daughters and women and their role in the Exodus, but not because I would argue that the four sons don't include four daughters also. Meaning, I think, you know, the language of sons is because the Torah talked to sons, but it means children. Okay, so now we're going to take a look at the first source, the Tosefta. So, again, in order to perhaps reinforce what I hope will be your astonishment as this particular collection of sources, I'm going to remind everyone that there is a principle, women are exempted from positive time-bound mitzvot. And many of you have taken Rachel's class, and some of you have taken my classes. That exemption is 1/4 of four different categories of mitzvot. Four is a very popular number in rabbinic literature, okay? Rabbinic halacha, even halacha, four categories. So women are included in all negative commandments, time-bound and non-time-bound. Women are included in non-time-bound positive mitzvot, okay, whatever that means. And women are exempted, not prohibited, from conducting mitzvot, for being, you know, from mitzvot that are time-bound in nature. And if you've been in my class or in Rachel's class, you know there's an ephemeral or kind of sticky, even I'm even having a hard time articulating it, quality to what time-bound means. Is time-bound on a daily basis? Is it on an hourly basis? Is it on a weekly basis? On a monthly basis? On a yearly basis? Not all the mitzvos fit into one kind of, you know, clear definition. Okay, so time-bound mitzvot. The way I would define it are the feel-good mitzvot, the fun mitzvot, meaning women were exempted from the mitzvot that largely lead to the kind of experiential connection. For instance, when I taught on your course, there was a program called Shevet. It was all about the feel-good mitzvot, not about any of the negative mitzvot, right? So we didn't really talk about prohibitions. What we did was we had them go and do kaparot, you know, wave the chickens around. Maybe we won't do that anymore, but on Yom Kippur, have them sit in a sukkah, have them go hear the shofar, maybe make a shofar, right? The kind of things that connect you to the Jewish calendar in a very direct way. Many of those mitzvot are mitzvot women are exempted from. Okay. By the way, the rabbis seem aware of this problematic situation of women being exempted from mitzvot that connect and start re-including them in a lot of time-bound mitzvot. What are the mitzvot women are re-included in? Kiddush, Hamotzi, Hanukkah, Megillah, meaning this principle, which seems very ironclad, ends up having a very porous quality to it. It's like a sieve with a lot of holes, meaning we have a principle, and then we start sifting out a lot of mitzvot that have time-bound quality that women should be exempted from but are included in. Again, this will be clearer as I go through it. I hope it's not too confusing. So if I would write on the board, and I know Rachel has a great, you know, kind of list, all of the mitzvot women are exempted from, it should be a pretty, you know, pretty complete board. But if I start taking out the exceptions to the rule, I end up with about half the board. Right? In other words, I have a rule, I have about 20 mitzvot that should fit on the board, and I end up with 8 that fit into the rule. Okay? That's really, again, something to think about. Why have a rule if you're going to have exceptions to the rule? Different conversation. On Pesach, unlike Rosh Hashanah, unlike Sukkot, women are going to be obligated in absolutely everything. Without hesitation. That's like really interesting. Because you would think Rosh Hashanah and Shofar, why not obligate them in Shofar? Why not obligate them in Sukkot, which is all about the harvest holiday and recognizing God's providence in the world? What is unique to Pesach that without question, women are obligated in every mitzvah of the night of the 15th and throughout the week? Okay, and so hopefully you won't. Let's take a look now. Let's go to the sources. The Tosefta. Chazeret Matzah and Pesach. On the first night of Pesach, they are obligatory. So the Tana Kama basically says, these three mitzvot, Chazeret, which is the Maror, Matzah, and Korban Pesach, everyone has to eat them on the first night of Pesach, unless what? When wouldn't you eat them? If you're Tameh, right? If you're impure. But then you get a do-over. Okay, so but we're going to get to Pesach Sheni actually on this source sheet. Pesach Sheni is, again, an unbelievable concept, a do-over. We know if we've read through the Torah, there are times in our lives where we become impure. What that means is not dirty, not impure as in you didn't use your right laundry detergent, but impure as in your body has put you into a state of impurity, either because you've come into contact with death, or you've had some sort of discharge from your sexual organ, or childbirth being one of those. Or you've contracted leprosy. That would be the most unpleasant form of impurity. You can't then eat sacrifices. So for instance, on Sukkot, which is a holiday with 70 sacrifices, meaning an enormous amount of sacrifices, you would not be able to go join the pilgrimage and celebrate with the nation of Israel. So on Passover, it makes sense. If you can't bring the Passover offering because you're impure, well, it's kind of tough luck. Not really different than the rest of the year when you can't bring your offerings. Wait for the next Pesach. But what the people come to Moshe in Numbers 9 and ask for is a do-over. They say, look, it's not fair. We don't want to be separated from the people in this kind of manner just because we were either burying our dead loved ones, we were on a journey far away, we happened to have gotten leprosy, that would be unfortunate. I mean, we want a do-over, which tells me that the Korban Pesach, the idea of sitting down with the Passover offering, is such a significant event that people don't want to miss the experience on a yearly basis. They don't want to wait another year. They want a second opportunity close to the first opportunity to participate in this event. So I'm going to talk about Pesach Sheni, because the question is, can women bring a Pesach Sheni? We're going to talk about that. So everyone understand the Pesach Sheni? Anyone? Anything not clear? Anyone have a question? I just want to, like, this.
Could you just clarify what that means again?
The Pesach Sheni means exactly 1 month from the 15th of Nisan, on the 14th of Iyar, between the 14th and the 15th, you can bring your Passover offering. You can bring it, you have a second chance to bring a Passover offering and to eat it with matzah and marah. Okay? So we find out here that on the first night of Pesach, they are obligatory, and the rest of the days of Pesach, optional. Obviously, you don't eat the Pesach after the morning of the 15th. You have to burn whatever's left. But you can eat your matzah and your marah for the next 7 days if you want to. And chazeret really is endive. Those who eat horseradish root and think that's the authentic experience, let me just inform you that in the Talmud, the authentic experience would have been endive or leafy romaine lettuce. But people in Poland and Russia feel much more authentic choking down the bitter herbs and feeling this is the bitterness of Egypt. And it's great because it just shows us that authentic meaning often comes from our experiences. And horseradish root, which I grew up with and I stopped using when I moved to Israel 25 years ago and learned Talmud, to me was a particularly painful part of the Seder, but it is bitter. I remember I was sitting there choking it down and my father saying, this is what the bitterness of Egypt was like. And you all felt very authentic, you know, like here we are, yes, this is really bitter. But it wasn't particularly enjoyable. So endive is a little nicer, a nicer experience, more Talmudic, but not as bitter. Okay. Rabbi Shimon then says, for men obligatory, for women optional. What we see here is a machloket, a difference of opinion between the Tana Kama, between the first Tana and Rabbi Shimon regarding women on this night of Passover, which is fine. Differences of opinion are legitimate. But I'm just showing you the Tana Kama doesn't distinguish between men and women. Rabbi Shimon is the one who tells us women should be exempt. Why? It's a positive time-bound mitzvah. I mean, the 15th at night on Nisan is about as time-bound as it comes. So it should be optional for women, not obligatory. Bepsachim. Okay, the next source, number two. Women are subject to the precept of eating unleavened bread by the law of Scripture. For it says, you shall not eat anything leavened with it. Whoever is subject to not eating anything leavened is subject to the eating of unleavened bread. And these women, since they are subject to the injunction of not eating anything leavened, they are also subject to the precept, arise, eat unleavened bread. So again, you may have heard this drasha before. Women are obligated to eating matzah because they're prohibited from eating chametz. So what does the author here say? It's unthinkable that in one verse, and it's the same verse, it says you may not eat chametz, eat matzah, and women only have to do half the verse. So again, it's logical. It does make sense. But I would argue again that it's a deliberate inclusion. It's a deliberate reading of the Torah text to include women as being equally obligated in matzah. What ramifications would that have, by the way, for those who have taken Rachel's class? Why do I care that men and women have an equal obligation? What does it say women can then do? They can then make the bracha even on matzah. We know they can do it on challah. But even on matzah, on this one night where matzah is super obligatory, where it's a d'oraita, where everyone has to eat their matzah. By the way, for gluten-free, I went out and spent 100 shekel on a box of shmura matzah because I want my daughters who don't eat gluten to fulfill their obligation. You can use any of the five grains. Obviously, people who have gluten issues can't do spelt and wheat. They can do oat. And that's how important it is to my family, that they be able to fulfill for one night their obligation. This is an important obligation, right? Just letting you know, Mea Sharim, possibly the only place in town to get the oat matzah. You can talk to me afterwards if you need oat matzah. Okay. And then send around a little cap collecting money so that you can afford the oat matzah. Our rabbis taught, if the son is wise, he asks, but if he is not wise, his wife asks. And if not, he asks himself questions. Now, I gave a talk Tuesday night at the Bina Yeshiva, the secular yeshiva in Tel Aviv, and the way I understand this verse is, initially you go to the son or the child. The purpose of the evening is the child-parent relationship, the asking, the telling, the engaging, the creating the memory together, passing on the memory. If the child is not wise or can't ask, you turn to the wife. Now, they found that to be very sexist, like the wife coming after the children. I would argue that this is highly unusual that we allow the wife to ask anything. I mean, if you've learned Talmud this year, you know that very rarely do we turn to the wife and say, and now it's your turn, darling, right? We just don't do that. In fact, when the wise woman known as the Matrona comes to ask questions, she's often deflected. And then the students say to Rabbi Yossi, it's often Rabbi Yossi, she asked a really good question, and you didn't really answer her. Answer us. We want to know the answer. You brushed her off, but that was a really good question, right? So when women ask questions, we often don't, you know, we kind of deflect the question. We push them out. We push them out of the Beit Midrash very deliberately. But in this night, the Bavli says, if the child isn't capable of asking questions that will engage you, your wife asks, because we're including her on this night. She's that relevant. Men, women, children, we're all sitting together. So if the child doesn't ask, and here it's interesting again to say, if the child doesn't have wisdom, eino chacham, ishto shoalato, I think that's a deliberate inclusion and an acknowledgement of the agency of his wife, of her ability to ask questions. I understand why someone would say to me, oh, but that sounds very condescending, you know, only after the child. But you have to know a lot of Talmud to understand how unusual this is. To have the wife being part of this chain of conversation. And then if she can't ask, if he doesn't have a wife, he asks himself. In other words, this whole night is about asking questions. It's not even about answers. It's about the questions. We know that because, as I said to my text in today class, some of the questions are just so you ask questions, like why do we eat karpas? So the children will ask a question, right? That's not really an answer. Why do we, the Tosefta has this wonderful image of chotef matzah, right? Grabbing the matzah. Well, why do they do that? So the children won't fall asleep, or the children will say, why are you doing that ridiculous thing, tug of war with the matzah, right? The idea is to ask the questions, and so you have to ask yourself questions, and even two scholars who know the laws of Pesach ask questions. So again, it's about the asking questions. The child asks, the wife asks, you ask yourself. But again, the wife is included. That's the part that I wanted to highlight. The next requires what's your name? I know you're Misha's father-in-law.
Robert.
As Robert already preempted, he the Pesach Sheni. So this Tosefta questions, do women bring Pesach Sheni? So let's see what it says. Pesach Rishon is slaughtered for women only, but for Pesach Sheni, she must join with others. This is the opinion of Rabbi Yehuda. So let me just give a little background. You cannot just show up on the Temple Mount and say, I'm here, I want my Korban Pesach. What you actually had to do, and this is also unique to Pesach, you had to pre-register. Are we good at doing that in Pardes? You got to pre-register. And I would argue the reason you have to pre-register is so that it does not deteriorate into haphazard kind of partying. Oh, let me join this party. This group's having more fun. Let me go here. You can do that on Purim. You can even do that on Shabbat. Pesach, in order for the structure of the evening to work, requires a kind of festive solemnity, right? We're all going out to the streets of Jerusalem. The potential for raucous celebration is definitely possible on this evening where the entire nation is supposed to be sitting side by side on the Temple Mount in the streets of Jerusalem. As a result, based on interpretation of the Psukim and onward, you actually had to come and pre-register and say, this is my group of 10, 15, 20, whatever it takes to finish the lamb or the goat or whatever it is you're eating, right? You got to finish it by the morning. So if you're a group of very picky, small, bird-like appetites, right, then you're going to need a lot of people to be in that group. If you're a bunch of 18-year-old soldiers, you're not going to need that many guys in the group. Just ask Papagayo, how much meat a group of soldiers goes through when they come to the all-you-can-eat meat buffet. So you're going to pre-register. And what this Tosefta tells us is it's legitimate for a group of women to come and register for their Korban Pesach. Why? Because they're obligated. Okay, again, very interesting, this idea of women-only group, men-only group, mixed groups, but no interaction between the two. But the question is, on Pesach Sheni, which is the do-over, Rabbi Yehuda isn't sure that the men and women have equal obligation for Pesach Sheni. After all, it was a group of men who came to Moshe. And so his feeling is she should really join a group of men. Men and women together should go for the Pesach Sheni. Rabbi Yossi then says, are you kidding? Pesach Sheni may be slaughtered for women only. Of course. The Pesach Sheni, the do-over, who's most likely to be impure? Women. They give birth. They give birth all the time. They get their periods all the time. It's more likely a woman will be impure. Of course, the problem is it's exactly 1 month later. So if they knew, they knew anything about biology, they would understand the chances are if you had your period on Pesach, you're going to have your period the next month also. But okay, we'll give them a little leeway. There's a good chance women will be impure for a variety of reasons. And so Rabbi Yossi says, of course they get the do-over just like the men. I mean, there's no difference here. Men and women have equal obligation in the first Pesach and in the do-over Pesach. And so he says there's no need to say the same for Pesach Rishon. And then we have Rabbi Eliezer, the son of the Rabbi Shimon, who already in the first source felt it's all optional for women because it's time-bound, saying, well, she has to actually join for others for the Korban Pesach, and certainly she shouldn't even bring a Pesach Sheni. Again, what we're seeing with Rabbi Shimon is the voice that's trying to be authentic to that principle of women are exempted from time-bound mitzvah. He often plays that role, by the way. He basically says, I don't understand, there's a rule, women are exempted. And Pesach Sheni, well, why are they even bringing a Pesach Sheni? That's a do-over. They were exempted the first time. There's no reason for them to even bring a second one. Okay, so I'm just showing you the dissenting opinion. We're not going to spend too much time on that. Moving on, Pesachim, also the Tosefta. These are the ones who do Pesach Sheni. This is a rejection of Rabbi Shimon's opinion. Those with discharge, notice again, who are the ones bringing the Pesach Sheni? Zavim Zavot, right, discharges from their sexual organs, menstruants, women after childbirth. Those are the prominent ones. It makes a lot of sense. So the Tana Kama, basically the Tosefta rules like Rabbi Yossi, that ultimately Pesach Sheni is about the women, and then they can have their own chabura, they can have their own gathering. Okay, so that's the beginning of the sources. Now comes a lovely vignette. I love little stories. Like, they sometimes just, it's the story that tells us the bigger picture. One who says to his son, so in all fairness, a man turns to his sons and says, I'm slaughtering the Pesach for the one who reaches Jerusalem first. What he says to his sons is as follows. Whoever makes it first, we call the lamb after you. So Jonathan, can I use your name? Do you mind?
Sure.
Okay. So if you get to Pesach first, Jonathan, then we're going to call the lamb we eat this year, Jonathan. Now, I know people who call their turkeys names, by the way. On Thanksgiving, we're going to be eating, we gave our turkey a name, Herbert, or Franklin, or something like that, and then we're eating Franklin. It would be considered a kind of, a big gold star, if you will. If whoever gets there first, we name the lamb for him this year. So we're going to be eating Jonathan's lamb this year, right, if he makes it first. On your marks, get set, go. Everyone races up. I have five sons. They're all racing up those hills up to Jerusalem. Whoever gets, it's meant to encourage the children, the sons, to get there first. And once he makes it first, he entitles the rest of the group to eat the Korban Pesach. Okay, so you got a little bit of a race. Rabbi Yochanan said the father was only training them to be zealous in mitzvot. Now, it's not really about acquiring anything. It's a little bit of a game. A case occurred. The daughters came to Jerusalem before the sons. Now, I love that. Because it was a family of boys and girls. You can see the father telling the boys, assuming they were going to win. And you can see the girls strategizing and making it there before the boys. Because they really want to do this mitzvah. And so now it's going to be called Melissa, right? We're going to call the lamb after Melissa. The daughters were zealous. The sons were lowly. Now, notice that they need to a little bit... They recognize a situation in which the daughters are zrizot. The daughters want to have the lamb called after them. They're so excited to do this mitzvah. So the Braita recognizes the model of daughters who are zrizot as opposed to sons who are kind of lazy. They're kind of trudging along. So this little vignette is so lovely. Because it shows us, again, that the daughters themselves understood the power of the metaphor, the power of the symbolism, the power of the obligation on this night, and they pushed themselves, and they made it first, defying the odds, of course, because really the son should have made it first. So it's a lovely little vignette. Okay.
Nechama?
Yeah.
Can I just ask on the previous one?
Yeah.
Does that mean women could be their own chagra?
Yes. Absolutely. That's what it means.
You can...
Yes, that's what Rabbi Yossi is saying, and that's what the Tosefta seems to rule by, the Rabbi Yossi approach, that women only chavura, right? Which, again, is so fascinating that they're willing to acknowledge. I don't know if any other situation, maybe Zimun, but Zimun is a little different, where you have women-only collectives for the purpose of doing a mitzvah that men are doing equally. And that's, it's, I think, very interesting. Rabbi Nachman Bar Yitzchak said, okay, and so I had taught this to my class, it'll be a quick review, that we already learned the resolution to this dilemma based on a related bright. So the question is, can women check for chametz? So I threw this in. The first few times I gave this share, I didn't include it, but I've taught this recently, and I wanted to include it as well. Women are normally not believed. Their testimony is not accepted. Again, let me give another class another day on women and witnessing. It's worthy of its own, its own shear. But women cannot be witnesses. Okay. But they're believed with regard to checking and eliminating chametz. And this astonishes the Talmud, because that's a pretty big deal. Meaning, chametz is really, really taboo. It's really problematic. And if you show up to your rented house, this is the example, you show up and the renter has left town, you're the tenant, and you need to know whether you have to check for chametz, you can ask a woman, it says, a woman or a child or a slave, wonderful category, was this house checked? And you can believe the women, okay? You can believe the women, you can believe the slaves, you can believe the minors, okay? Because it's assumed they'll take this seriously. In the next source, which is in the Yerushalmi, all are believed with regard to nullification of chametz, even women, even slaves. This astonishes Rabbi Yermia, who says, why are you saying even women? Women themselves, and I really should have corrected this, erase the box, are believed because they are, there are two possibilities, sluggish, meaning like slow, they do it slowly, or lazy. Eliminate the lazy, please. The Yerushalmi clearly doesn't mean lazy. It's for a different class I give on manuscript errors. They check a little bit, a little bit. Rabbi Yermia says, how can you put them in the category of slaves and children? The women are so thorough. Maybe we shouldn't let them do it because they'll end up spending all night. Then they'll be too tired for the Seder. But they're so thorough, they check a little bit at a time. It's not even women. Women are believed. Okay, and so again, this idea that we believe women, even though we don't accept their testimony in other cases. Okay, next source. Rabbi Yoshua ben Levi said, women are obligated in the four cups, since they too were involved in the miracle. So here is another, this is a rabbinic obligation, the four cups of wine. We've already established women eat all of the biblical obligations, the Korban Pesach, the Maror, the Matzah. That we've established. Pesach Sheni we've established. Now we're moving into rabbinic waters. And again, rabbinically it would be easy to exempt them. We have a principle. Why not exempt them from all these other, not to mention wine, wine and women. What a fertile ground for promiscuity, for seduction, for debauchery, right? Not to mention we're going to get to the reclining, right? We've got reclining going on and wine. Oh, my goodness. How are they not thinking the way they often think? This is ripe for problem. This is going to be a problem. No, women are obligated in the four cups since they, too, were involved in the miracle. So they, too, were involved in the miracle. I'm going to bring the Tosfot because the Tosfot was really the link that led me to kind of the thesis I developed. Rashbam understands this as a reference to the Agadah that the Israelites were redeemed from Egypt because of the merit of the women. Similarly, the redemption commemorated by the Megillah was effected by Esther and that of Hanukkah by Judith. So this idea that women are obligated, absolutely equally obligated, in mitzvot, in which they are part of the miracle, is something that the Rishonim, Tosfot, Rashbam, put forward that, if we're equally obligated when women are part of the miracle. Okay. The Shulchan Aruch then says also the women are obligated in four cups and in all of the mitzvot observed on that same night. So the Shulchan Aruch says it, the halachic ruling is women have to do everything just like men on the night of Pesach. The Ramah then adds something again, in a language that women and children understand, or the matter will be explained to them. And so did Rabbi Yehuda of Landari, who told the whole Haggadah in secular language so that the children and women will understand. This is not going to synagogue, mumble, 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 kind of listen, I don't know what they're saying, but let me just try to follow along in my art scroll or whatever it is. They're saying it in the authentic language. The symbolism, the meaning, the power of this night is such, it has to be said in a language so that women understand, which is, again, we don't usually do that. Usually we say it in the ancient language, and then you translate it. You want to do it that way, you translate. You say it in the Hebrew or in the Aramaic, and then you translate it, right? Here, no translation. There has to be direct interaction between the text and the people at the Seder. I know today, look, we all thankfully have printed Haggadahs, right? You can imagine at a time where only the leader had the Haggadah, right? Then it would be important for him to say it in one language. Today we can follow along in multiple languages. But this idea, this sensitivity, that women are equally part of this Seder. So are the children, I'm not denying that, but women are obligated. Children are just expected to participate. Children are not obligated. And so we'll translate it into another language for the women. Now we get to reclining. Even a poor person in Israel shall not eat until reclines. A woman who is with her husband does not require leaning, and if she is an important woman, she requires leaning. Okay, so this piece of Talmud also very, we don't really know what to do with it. Here we have the wine, we have the reclining. Are they worried that a married woman is more susceptible to some sort of inappropriate behavior than an unmarried woman? Is that what they're worried about at all? What's the problem with reclining in front of your husband? If your husband's there, it should be easier to recline. This leads to a variety of positions in the Rishonim, which I'll share a few of them with you, and then I'll wrap up. This is really the last piece before we get to the Agada. Yes. Two positions emerge post-Talmud to try to understand this piece of Talmud, that a woman reclines, just like a poor person, everyone reclines. In front of her husband, she does not have to recline. It's not, she can't, it's that she does not have to recline. And the reason she doesn't have to recline, well, the Talmud doesn't tell us. So two theories emerge. Out of fear for her husband, she's afraid of her husband. She doesn't want to recline because that's like taking liberties in front of her. What, do you think you're so free? You're reclining very nicely. I hope you're giving her permission, Jonathan. Yeah, yeah. You know, out of fear for her husband. Or the She'iltot, the Gaonim actually say something very different. They don't see women reclining. The custom is women don't recline. The She'iltot say, look, I don't understand. Women should recline, so why don't they have to recline? It's because women don't recline. Now, that's very different, because that would be coming from the women. It becomes very interesting. If the women aren't reclining, is it because we didn't educate them, but we tell them they have to recline? Is it because they don't want to recline? They're not comfortable reclining. Are married women less comfortable reclining than unmarried women? Meaning the She'iltot seem to suggest it's behavioral. The Rashbam seems to suggest, no, this is not behavioral. This is more of a sociological phenomenon. Women are afraid of men. Women are afraid of their husbands. Wives are afraid of their husbands. The She'iltot are saying women don't seem to want to recline. How are we going to convince them to recline? Do we have to convince them? But the clause, if she is an important woman, she must recline, is an important clause. What does that mean, an important woman? Any suggestions? Why would a woman be important? And then she has to recline. Then it's not optional. What's an important woman? Okay. Yes. Financial independence is a big one. There's a, yes, the Talmud refers in several places to important women, especially on Shabbat. Important women can go out with heavy headpieces of gold. Why? Because they're not going to take it off to show their friends. An important woman doesn't stop in the street when a friend says, I love your ring, and takes it off to say, why don't you take a look at it and then maybe come to carry it in the marketplace. Important women don't behave that way. They are seen. Right, they are looked at, but they are not the ones taking off their, you know, their bonnets or their jewelry like we sometimes do. Someone says, "I like your necklace." I look down. Oh, yeah, can I see it? Sure, here, take it. Right, an important woman would not be subject to that kind of interaction. Right, and so wealth seems to be a very big part of that. Okay, why else? What else makes someone important?
Yichus,
very good. Were you going to say that, Jessica? What were you going to say? Okay, you're saying how she raises the family. I think in the eyes, important. She's like a matriarch, and you're saying Yichus, her father, her husband. She may be the daughter of an important rabbi, the wife of an important rabbi. Yes, absolutely.
Would she be learned?
Okay, education. Yes, yes. So education, wealth, status, possibly again the in the eyes of the family, an important woman, something very specific. But we see here on Pesach, on one hand, a statement. Everyone reclines, even a poor person. A step back, a woman who is with her husband is not required. If she's an important woman, she's required. Okay, that's a little, a lot to kind of process. And the Rashbam then saying, well, it's out of fear for her husband. And then the Mordechai, and we do love the Mordechai, he comes and he says, all of our women are important. All of our women are important. This is an Ashkenaz. All of our women, and the Tosafists pick that up as well. All of our women. There are no unimportant women. All... Like, who said Jessica? That's going to take Jessica's idea and really develop it. What do you mean all of our wives? Wives who bear our children, who clean our homes, and so on and so forth. All of our women are important on this night. On this night. If we take a look at the Kesef Mishnah, Rav Manoach writes that the meaning of important women is she has no husband and is the head of the household. Someone actually asked me that, which is, again, very interesting to understand that. Dafka, the widow, who is often, you know, kind of the vulnerable member of society, the divorcee, on this night, she's important, right? Because she has been elevated to the head of the household. She's going to run the Seder. There's something different about this night. We look at women differently on this night. Alternatively, she is important by virtue of the fruits of her hands, the daughter of the leaders of the generation, as Aviva said, a woman of valor and God-fearing, or she is important in that she has men servants and maid servants so that she does not have to busy herself with cooking and housework. Another possible interpretation of important, which again would be that of wealth. And so so we see that important women have to recline. They have to recline. They have to kind of engage in this very visceral way, this very experiential way, the metaphor of this evening, which is freedom, which is why is this night different? And we look at women differently on this night. I just want to conclude with this lovely little piece from Rav Moshe Feinstein. Rav Moshe Feinstein is actually trying to find a way to suggest women don't have to drink 4 cups of wine. We saw in the Talmud women have to drink 4 cups of wine. We can imagine that for many women that's difficult. Again, not for many men. I want to say, there are people for whom it is difficult to drink 4 cups of wine. What about pregnant women? I mean, they can't possibly drink 4 cups of wine, right? It would endanger their pregnancy, so that for sure. But Rav Moshe has basically asked, do we really have to drink 4 cups of wine, or is there a way out? Now, we drink grape juice. I don't know if in the 1960s, 70s, what's going on. There's Manischewitz, and hopefully something better than Manischewitz to drink as well. But it could be that grape juice hasn't become the marketable commodity that it is today. And so he's being asked, do women have to drink 4 cups of wine? And by the way, Rav Moshe Feinstein, does everyone know who he is? Moshe Feinstein, one of the greatest rabbinic authorities in the last century. He throws in the difference between reclining, which he thinks all women have to do, and drinking of 4 cups, which he thinks women do not have to do. Okay. Is it a mitzvah and the wish of the sages that she should fear her husband in everyday matters that do not concern him, particularly when disregarding a mitzvah is at stake? Wow, I wish he would say that other times of the year. But what he says on this night is, really, her husband is going to prevent her from doing a mitzvah out of fear of her husband? I'll just remind those who have taken women in Judaism and with me or with Rachel that the Abud Raham actually says the reason women do not do certain mitzvot is because they need to fear their husbands. So notice how Rav Moshe is kind of subverting that idea. He's saying, well, a man would prevent his wife from doing a mitzvah? He would want her to be so afraid of him that she's not going to do a mitzvah? That's ridiculous. I mean, what is that? That's what the sages wanted? Furthermore, it is not a good thing for a husband to be exacting towards his wife, and we see that for the last several hundred years, they do not insist on this, as we see in the Beit Yosef, in the name of the Ri, in the name of the Tosfot, that all of our women are important and are required to recline. And the Mordechai cites this as well. It is not possible to explain that all women have literally become important, which will require that their husbands respect them, even as they would respect important people in everyday life. We can't say that all women are leaders of their generation, and so that all men have to treat their wives as if they're objectively important people. Rather, we must conclude that over the course of time, they recognized that men have no reason to feel superior to their wives. Listen well. And women recognized the great need that their husbands had for them. I cannot underscore, I know this sounds very paternalistic and apologetic, but Rav Moshe Feinstein is a leader in the ultra-Orthodox community, in the Hasidic community. And so this equal but different is not a small thing. Meaning I know for us, for feminists, for people who are pushing for equal but equal, not equal but different, this is somewhat patronizing. But in the world in which he lives, to make a statement like that, men have no reason to feel superior, when hundreds of years of commentary and interpretation have reinforced that idea. Men are superior. Men are, again, this idea that women are spiritually superior is a very, very, very modern idea. In the Middle Ages, it was men are spiritually superior, need more mitzvot. Women are spiritually inferior, need less mitzvot. So what he's saying here, that men recognize their wives' importance and women recognize that their husband recognizes their importance, is not a small thing. Okay, I know for us it's not; it may not be enough, but it's actually a very important statement. The minority who were important in all times were those women who recognized the need for their husbands and who knew their husbands were aware of this as well. In other words, he says important. He's going back to the Talmud and saying important doesn't mean leaders. It means regular women, regular housewives, and women, whatever their role was in the family, who saw that their husbands recognized that they were important exactly the way Jessica said. But it's innovative because the Talmud, when it talks about important, talks about wealthy women or women who have yichus. What Reb Moshe is saying is very modern. This idea that the minority of women at that time saw that their husbands needed them. And in that way, they recognized they were important in the household. But that wasn't an obvious interpretation in the Talmud, right? It's Reb Moshe is going back to the Talmud and saying, oh, in those days, not enough women knew how much their husbands appreciated, recognized, valued, esteemed, recognized that they were equal but different, but equal. And he says, today, that's all of our women. Meaning, who doesn't recognize that, right? And so there is something that's meant to be somewhat empowering. So reclining is not something new, but they decreed that the eating and drinking that was obligated by the Torah to recognize the freedom and redemption will be in a manner in which there will be an even greater recognition of freedom. And since women are also required by the Torah to eat matzah in order to recognize this, So basically, that this is the explicit reason given in the Torah. It's a kind of run-on sentence that every person has to say while he is saying Haggadah and so on. It is relevant to, turn the page, obligate women in this decree as well, that so she eats in a manner that brings full awareness of this freedom. Women need to be fully aware of the freedom we are commemorating on this night, and reclining is one of the ways in which we do this. But drinking the four cups, which is a new enactment, since it is only rabbinic, it is not necessary to obligate the women, which is fascinating because the Talmud says women are obligated in the four cups. So I felt like he spent this whole time explaining that reclining is practically biblical, which it isn't. But okay, that's an interesting distinction. Reclining is practically biblical, so women have to recline to feel freedom. But the four cups, well, that's rabbinic, and so it's not necessary to obligate the women. I don't remember what the question was. I kind of glanced at it. But I assume, again, women were having a hard time, and he wanted to give them a way out. Okay, but okay, so that really wraps up the first part of the section. What we've seen here is women are fully obligated. This is a night, unlike Rosh Hashanah, unlike Sukkot, I'm trying to think if there's another good example. Unlike, you know, the prayer services where women are exempted from, not prayer, from Shema, from Tefillin, from Tzitzit, women are obligated in all of the rituals of this evening. It's a little like Shabbat, but it takes a lot more time. Meaning if we argue that time-bound is so that women can serve their husbands, the more modern reread is the children. By the way, all of the Middle Age sources talk about the wife and her husband. It's in the last 50 years, I'm guessing, Chabad and Eish. Together, realized that wasn't going to work so well in Kiruv to say, oh, you're equal but different because you have to take care of your husbands. But to talk about the children, really the last 50 to 100 years is where that kind of idea, that kind of suggestion comes forward as why women don't do certain mitzvot. No one says it on this night. In fact, how many of us have the mothers and grandmothers where you say, Bubby, just sit, we'll get to the meal, we'll help you, and Bubby's in the kitchen. You're like, no, Bubby, you really should sit. No, I've got to check on the soup, I've got to make sure the matzo balls, and so on. You practically have to tie them to the chair, right? I don't see the Zadies doing that, right? It's the Bubbies. So, again, part of the problem is when you exempt women all year, it's hard for them to understand, no, you're really, really obligated tonight. You're really, really part of this. I know, but the children... I've got to make sure the children have food. No, Bubby, we'll feed the children. Okay. So women who help bring about the redemption. What I want to look now are at the Agadic text, and I think this is a great example of where Agada and Halacha work together in synchronization to underscore this, that really emphasize the importance of women on this night. The legend was told. So at the beginning of Shemot, we really have six women who emerge as being leaders and saviors. Six women conspire to save baby Moshe. You're doing it, Nathan. Did you get to it? Yeah, you've got Shifra and Pua, the midwives. You have the daughter of Levi, who we find out later is Yocheved. We have the daughter of Paro, who also is not named. You have the sister of baby Moshe, we later find out is Miriam. We have Tzipora. Tzipora, of course, saves Moshe in chapter... chapter 4, where he's seems to be endangered by the malach, by the angel, and she circumcises the child and saves the child, Moshe, something like that. Okay. So what I want to look at are some midrashim, because I think through the midrashim, we see the way they're looking at the women in that story, and then we'll bring it all together. The legend was told by Rabbi Yehuda Bar Zavina. Amram, the father of Miriam, was great in his generation. When he heard Pharaoh proclaim, "All the sons that are born you shall cast into the Nile," Amram said, "We are toiling in vain." Amram divorced his wife, and the men following his example also divorced their wives. So the Midrash in Shemot Rabbah, we're going to see a few examples from Shemot Rabbah. Shemot Rabbah is a Midrash from about 800 CE. And what it's examining is, what were the men thinking at this time? What were the women thinking at the time? This is going to be a very gendered conversation. The men give up. The men basically say, we're toiling in vain. Toiling is seems to be a euphemism for having sexual relations that lead to pregnancy. Of course, the men don't really toil. The women toil, but okay. The men are toiling in vain. Our seed is being wasted, so to speak, because the boys are being thrown into the Nile. And his decision is, says the Midrash, divorce the women. Refrain from sexual relations. There's just no point. We're going to see a slight riff on that in the last source I bring. Amram divorced his wife, and the men following his example also. Everyone divorces their wives. His daughter Miriam said to her father, "You condemned us more than Pharaoh, because he only condemned the males, but you condemned the males and females. What Pharaoh decreed was only for this world, but your decree is for this and the next world." So his daughter Miriam, who's very young, even this Midrash, has the wisdom of a wise woman, and basically says, here's your flaw. You're getting rid of the baby girls. Meaning Pharaoh only decreed against the boys. I know that's a heavy price to pay. But what you're doing is you're removing the baby girls from the picture. And of course, it's through the baby girls that continuity is ensured. I mean, yes, we need both. But ultimately, save the wombs, and you may very well save the future. Pharaoh is a villain, so there is no doubt about whether his decree will be fulfilled, but you are a just man, so it is sure that your decree will be obeyed. In other words, she says, why are you giving in to Pharaoh, who's wicked? It suggests faith that there will be salvation. God's going to listen to Pharaoh. Ultimately, God will come and save his people. But you're a righteous man, and people are going to obey you, and the damage you're going to do in some ways is going to be more permanent and long-lasting and problematic than that of Pharaoh. So what happens? Amram listened to his daughter and took back his wife Yocheved. All of his followers remarried their wives. So basically, again, Amram listens to his daughter. Again, we're talking about the daughters. He takes back his wife Yocheved. Everyone remarries. The child Miriam and her brother sang and danced at the ceremony, which is a very sweet little description. When Miriam was five, so all this took place before Miriam was five, her mother was pregnant with Moses. Miriam prophesies, "My mother is about to bear a son who will save Israel from Egypt." The Midrash has a lot of plays on the prophecy of the child who will be born, right? This idea of a child is born and the child will be the savior. We have many Midrashim that Pharaoh was aware of this prophecy and was terrified, and so, you know, kind of tested out baby boys here and there to see if they were going to be the savior. That's why the baby boys were being thrown into the river, because of the savior. On the day Moses was born, the house was filled with light, which is very like the light of creation, right? He or this idea that Moses, when he was born, a light. Okay, we see certain, when you read certain books in the New Testament, the birth of baby Jesus sounds a lot like the birth of baby Moses, both in the Midrash and in the biblical text. David Satran has a lot of, I believe, articles written on Midrash in New Testament, right? And so this idea of the light, you know, the light filled the house or surrounded the house. Her father Amram kissed Miriam on the head and said, "Your prophecy was fulfilled." Wow. 3 months later, her brother was put into a basket and set floating on the Nile. Her mother hit her on the head, not the loveliest of description, and asked, "Daughter, now, where is your prophecy?" That is why what is said in the Hebrew Bible, the child sister took her stand at a distance to see what would happen to him. When years later it was time for the exodus, so she takes responsibility again. Okay. Years later it was time for the exodus, Miriam sang and danced her people to victory. The house of Israel sang a song of freedom to the sound of Miriam's tambourine. So again, Miriam is credited. Miriam gives her parents hope, her father hope. She convinces them to go back, not just reunite, but to allow pregnancy to happen. A child is born, the Savior is born, Miriam's prophecy is correct. It's why she's called Miriam Nevi'ah. Again, what is the Midrash doing here? When did she ever give a prophecy? We don't have any prophecy of Miriam. So this they tie together all these little threads around Miriam's description in the Torah, very, very few threads, and they fill in the gaps, right? They create a narrative. It's a beautiful narrative, the narrative of Miriam, the sister, who stands nearby to protect, but also there is some self-interest, right? She wants to ensure that her prophecy is fulfilled, and so she has to make sure the baby doesn't drown in the Nile, so to speak, or at least see what's going to happen to the baby. And that's why she is so central in singing her, dancing her people to victory. Okay, so that's a very famous midrash about Miriam, about her role, about the hope of women, the reluctance of women to give up. All of the midrashim we're going to see about women are about fertility and birth and renewal. Okay, questions, comments before we move on? The next section is about the midwives. And so some of this, I have to give Judy Klitzner some credit. She has a beautiful chapter on this. Let me just get it to her. If you have a Tanakh next to you, you can open it. It's Exodus chapter 1. Okay, again, I see Aviva here. She's been in my classes on this topic. If any other CE people are here, they might have heard some of this as well. We have this idea of Pharaoh working very hard to figure out how to dehumanize the Israelites, how to do it subtly, how to do it discreetly. And what we have... what we have is calling in the midwives, and their nationality is unclear. It's not clear if they're Hebrew midwives or Egyptian midwives. Again, for another class, the Hebrew is uncertain. In the JPS, they choose to translate Hebrew midwives, but that's because a translator has to make a decision. So the translator interprets Hebrew midwives. One of them was Shifra, one of them is Pua. And basically, Pharaoh says to them something that shows, again, I love this. It shows how he misunderstands women. Okay? He, the big boss, the big Pumba, the big leader of the entire, you know, world at the time, calls in the women and assumes they're going to obey him. And what ends up unfolding in the next 10, 15, 20 verses is how clearly he misunderstands women and daughters, particularly daughters, because it's the daughters who are going to defy him, including his own daughter, which is the biggest irony of all. But what he says to midwives, whose job is to bring life into the world, is what I want you to do is look at the birth stool. If it's a boy, kill him. If it's a girl, let her live. Okay? Very simple, very clear instructions. You have the opportunity as the baby slides out to see the sex of the child. If it's a boy, kill the boy. If it's a girl, let her live. Now, not only is it a vile thing to ask, but he's particularly asking it of women whose life calling is to bring life into the world. And what we find out is they fear God. And they fear God, which is why the translators go to Hebrew midwives. Personally, I prefer the interpretation of Egyptian midwives, because anyone can fear God. It's not limited to us. And I think the Torah is actually telling us that by saying, you know, individuals, other people can fear God and do the right thing. This does not require a call from one, you know, our God. This is intuitive. This is people drawn to morality. This is people drawn to doing the right thing. And it can come from anywhere. And so we have other examples of this. I've talked about it in my text for today class. And we have other examples of this in the Torah, non-Hebrews who are righteous, who fear God. I think this is another example. He did not do as the king of Egypt told, and they let the boys live. And then the king of Egypt calls them in, and I think in a brilliant dialogue, he says, "Why have you done this, letting the boys live?" And then they use his language to say, the Hebrew women are not like the Egyptian women. Again, the translation is they are vigorous. The Hebrew is chayotena. And I think chayotena is they're animals. I mean, what do you want from us? You've told us they're not really like us. You've dehumanized them. We get there, they squat down and give birth, meaning Egyptian women. They wait for the midwife. I mean, they just wait. They don't seem to know what to do. They have to wait for instruction. But the Israelite women, they're like animals. They just squat down. They do. I mean, what do you want? They're primitive, right? So you told us to be discreet. How can we be discreet? The baby's already born, right? It's brilliant. Mm-hmm. And it's because they fear God, and they use his language against him, and they defeat him. And that's where the Midrash comes in and says, the Midrash does two things. The Midrash, first of all, names them as Miriam and Yocheved. Why does the Midrash do that? Because the Midrash likes to claim heroes for ourselves, number one, meaning these are two heroic women who may or may not be Hebrew. I had a great vort from a Pardes student a number of years ago, which I always like to share. that it's possible they look like Egyptian women, but they're actually Hebrew women. Why? Because society was patrilineal. So if Hebrew women married Egyptian men, the assumption would be that they would become Egyptian. And so when Pharaoh calls them in, they look Egyptian, but they're really Hebrew, which is a very nice reading of the problematic in the language, the Mialdot La Ivriot, right? They're both, actually. And when push comes to shove, their identity is really God-fearing, right? And that comes maybe from the Hebrew side of them. So I like that. I mean, I think it's an interesting idea that he, again, totally misunderstands who they are. He assumes the women's allegiance is to their husbands. He doesn't recognize their allegiance might be to their fathers or to something greater than themselves, right? It might be from the home they were born into. So the Midrash here, and you have it on your source sheet, says that these are the women, Achayata Yehudaita, they're Jewish, the first source is Unglas, they're Jewish midwives. Notice again, he calls them Yehudaita. There are no Jews in the Bible. They are Hebrews. They haven't yet even become Israelites, right? And so Unglas is using the language of 300 CE and saying, oh, these are the Jewish midwives. One is Shifra, one is Pua. And then in the text below, Targum Yerushalmi, I'm on page 4, I'm in the Hebrew text, he at least calls them Yulodaita Ivriata. He says the midwives of the Hebrews. And then he explains, one is Yocheved, one is Miriam. Yeah, it is getting very hot in here. And then Rashi says, well, yeah, Shifra is Yocheved, Pua is Miriam, okay, because she makes the baby shapely, she coos to the baby, okay, a play on the words. Let's turn the page to 5. I'll finish with the, I'll bring the Malbim and Abarbanel, because the Midrash really wants to often limit the cast of characters. In other words, are you going to remember Shifra and Pua, or are you going to remember them better because they're Miriam and Yocheved? Meaning, we never hear of Shifra and Pua again. In an oral tradition where you're passing on stories, it will be easier to remember a story if there's something to it that catches your memory. And so the Midrash is known, this is Yitzhak Heinemann's idea, not my own, it likes to limit the cast of characters. So when we have a woman that appears once, we're going to try to tie her to a woman that appears more than once. We do it with Yiska, right? In the book of Bereishit, we have this idea that Nahor's daughter is named Yiska, and the Midrash says, oh, that's Sarah. Well, Sarah and Yiska don't sound anything like each other. But if we want the name of Yiska to be remembered, my chavruta just called her daughter Yiska. I think it's a beautiful name. It means princess. We do a lot by saying that's Sarah, because that means Sarah's name really means she's a princess, and really she's the niece of Avraham, and that helps explain the stories when Avraham calls her sister, because niece and sister, at least there's a kind of relationship there. So we gain a lot by the Midrashic rereading in order to preserve the memory of that text. Because I'm just giving another example of how the Midrash conflates the cast of characters. Malbim. And if he, Paro, had wanted the matter to be public, he would not have needed to have it done in private by the midwives. He could have just ordered them to throw the males into the Nile. But in the beginning, he was embarrassed to have such murder carried out publicly and wanted it done privately. He thought the Egyptian midwives hated Israel and would do it gladly. Okay, so this is the idea they were Egyptian. It shows how much he misunderstood the women. Abarbanel. And these midwives were not Hebrews, because how could he trust Hebrew midwives to kill their own children? But these were Egyptian midwives who birthed the Hebrew women, meaning they helped them birth, and so on. And these midwives, although Egyptian, feared God and did not do what the king of Egypt commanded them to do until he came to rebuke them. Why did you do this thing and have saved the man children alive? Okay, in other words, the text is not repeating itself. Rather, I'm not going to go into this because we're not having a class in Tanakh, but basically, look at the bottom. Not only did you not kill them, but you saved them. Not only did they not actively kill them, but they helped them survive by nurturing them when they emerged from the womb. And in fact, they ensured the survival of the newborn babies. After the fact, he recognizes how complicit they were. It wasn't just that they allowed the babies to live. Babies died at an astonishing rate. Meaning, infant mortality was tremendous until about 1700s, 1800s, we know this for interesting reasons. They start studying how many babies are dying in the late 1700s, 1800s, and infant mortality begins to go down. And then they notice when babies begin to die after circumcision. Okay, it's a different class that babies die after circumcision because of what's called oral suction, right? And the germs in the mouth of the circumciser. So they begin to be able to study that because babies aren't dying from diphtheria and scarlet fever at the same rate. I assume some sort of vaccinations are emerging. And so babies die at an astonishing rate. It's not just the birth. They contract all sorts of diseases. And Pharaoh understands, says the Abarbanel, that the midwives aren't just saving the babies. They're nurturing them so that they continue to live beyond, you know, the first 24 hours of life. Okay. Megillah 13a. I want to go on to the last two sources. Rabbi Shimon ben Pazi once introduced an exposition. Now we're going to, okay, before I do that, I have to go back to the biblical text. Remember that the last word in chapter 1 is, every boy that is born you shall throw into the Nile, but let every daughter live. And then a certain man went and married a certain Levite woman. But again, a man from the house of Levi took the daughter of Levi. The translation doesn't do it justice. He just said, let the daughters live, and a daughter of Levi comes and gets pregnant with the Savior. No name. She's just known as daughter, the daughter of Levi. And then, of course, the next daughter who comes is Pharaoh's daughter. And this idea, well, let the daughters live. They can do no harm. They can add to our harems of women. They can be our playthings, if you will, or our concubines, or our wombs to bring forth the Egyptian nation. He is completely subverted by his decree, let the daughters live, echoes in the background of chapter 2, as three daughters come forward and essentially save the Savior, including his own. The irony is just tremendous. Let the daughters live, and then the daughter of Paro comes. And so what happens in the Midrash, they don't like the idea that the daughter of Paro just disappears. I mean, that's it. She goes back to the house of Pharaoh and saves baby Moshe, and then we never hear of her again. So they give her a name. They give her a name from a woman who appears in the book of Chronicles and is called, these are the sons of Bitya, the daughter of Pharaoh, whom Mered took. In other words, in Chronicles, we have this idea that the daughter of Pharaoh, same daughter, different daughter, joins the Jewish people. And why is she the daughter of Pharaoh called a Jewess? Because she repudiated idolatry. This idea that she went down to bathe in the river to cleanse herself from the idols of her father's house. Again, the need to turn her into a Jew. Right? It's a little bit like Shifra and Puah have to be Miriam and Yochanan, the daughter of Paro, this Bitya, the daughter of God. Bitya, literally Bat-ya, right? The daughter of God becomes the daughter of Pharaoh who saved baby Moses. Again, a Midrashic idea, but yet another woman who has been elevated up has become a central part of our memory and our narrative, and of course converts, because that's what she would do. And then I'm going to end with the Midrash that I just taught last week, so Aviva, you'll forgive me, but really, and my text in today class, but you know this is one of my favorite ones, and for those who haven't heard me teach it, hopefully you'll enjoy it. You find them when the Israelites suffered hard labor in Egypt. These are the women that the Tosfot are talking about, the righteous women who raised up the hosts of Egypt. That Pharaoh decreed they should not sleep at home nor have relations with their wives. So this is the Midrash Tanchuma. That's saying it's not Amram who separated from his wife and led to separation. It's Pharaoh who deliberately separates the men from the women because he doesn't really want to kill all the baby boys. That's clear. It's better to enforce celibacy. It's much easier, much less messy. No one gets pregnant, and then we don't have any problems. Said Rabbi Shimon ben Chalafta, what did the daughters of Israel do? They would go down to draw water from the river. So again, the daughters of Israel go down to draw water. I think it's clear that they see their own reflections as well because we're going to see mirrors in this midrash, but if you go down to draw water, you're near a source of fertility, you're near water, you see a reflection in the water. What comes out in this midrash is the daughters don't lose their identity. The men have lost their identity. Okay. Whereupon the Holy One, blessed be He, prepared small fishes for them inside their jars. So God is completely complicit in what is about to become a major and quite erotic seduction scene. He sends them little fishes. And the little fishes swim in, and fishes are a sign of fertility. And there are so many fishes, they would cook some, sell some, and buy wine. Now, again, that's why I said wine as the setting the scene for a seduction scene is very prevalent in rabbinic literature. And so they go and they take the fishes and they cook them. So they're going to feed their husbands, but they're also going to seduce their husbands. And they use the proceeds from the fishes to do that. There is enough fish for feeding and for nurturing and for seducing. Lots of fish to go around. Okay. And they go out to the fields. After they had eaten, they took out their mirrors, which they happened to have in their robes, and look into them together with their husbands. And so this is a lovely, again, detail. This midrash is just filled with beautiful little details. They take out their mirrors after they've eaten and drunk the wine. And again, the mirrors are a sign of identity. Whatever you think about mirrors, when we look in the mirror, we know what we look like. And if we're using the mirror in an effective, mindful way, we often know who we are. We can, if we're honest with ourselves, I'm in a bad mood, I'm in a good mood. I'm going to do the job willfully. I'm resisting going out today to work. I don't really want to go. Look at my face. I see. I'm like really, really in a bad mood, right? If we're honest, we can often see ourselves and truth about ourselves in the mirror. We can also see how our hair looks and if our makeup's on right, which is also very important. Okay. And they look into them together with their husbands. And this is a very erotic detail. There are books. I believe The Unbearable Lightness of Being has a scene with a mirror. Mirrors are used for erotic kind of love play, lovemaking. And she said, "I am more beautiful than you." And I love that line because it could only start with the women. I always say this, but I think it's true. I know if anyone did this to my daughters, they would then, you know, if a man said to my daughter, "I am more beautiful than you," they would end up crying in the corner saying he doesn't think I'm beautiful. That's not the women can start with this. Why? Because the Midrash shows an understanding of male ego. They're definitely an understanding. That if you say to a man, "I am stronger than you, I am more beautiful than you, I am better than you," the instinctive response is, "What are you talking about? I'm more beautiful than you, I'm stronger than you," right? I don't think it would work if the men started this dialogue. It only works because the women are starting this dialogue. And again, this is from 800 CE, people. The insightfulness is really quite astonishing. And she looks in the mirror and she sees herself and she says, "I am more beautiful than you." And then he says, "I am more beautiful than you," which is the purpose. Why? The men have separated from their wives. They've left the homes. They've lost their identity. The women who go down to the river and have mirrors have not lost their identity. And they force the men to look at themselves, and they say to the men, "I still exist. Where are you? I'm here. Look at me. I'm beautiful. I'm more beautiful than you." And then the men look in the mirror and say, "No, wait, I'm here. I exist. I am more beautiful than you." In the course of this tete-a-tete, sexual desire was aroused. And of course sexual desire is aroused here. Because the most potent form of sexual desire is when two individuals come together in a mindful, respectful, consensual way to engage in intimacy and pleasure while retaining their identities, right? Not losing themselves, not losing sight of who they are. And that's what they're demanding of their husbands. We don't want animal coupling. We don't want just a physical release. We want desire. Desire requires intimacy. Desire requires you to know who you are. Wake up, look in the mirror, know who you are. And that's what they force the men to do. And the men, by holding out the mirror, are forced. They look at, "Oh, I'm more beautiful than you. Well, let me see that. Let me take a look. Wait, no, right?" And so it brings up this kind of awakens the I language, the competitive I language, which is what they're trying to do. And so basically, God then blesses them with remembering, and they become fruitful, swarming, and multiplying. I will say, I don't think this source is only about sexuality leading to fertility. In this particular case, that's the reward, because this is Egypt and we're trying to raise up the hosts. I think the vignette about the mirrors and sexual desire reflects a kind of a Jewish understanding, or the Midrash's understanding about what healthy sexuality is. So I think there are two elements going on here. The fact that the reward is progeny or fruitfulness because it's appropriate for the time, but I think the statement about awakening sexual desire through individual identity is a very powerful one, knowing your identity. As soon as the Holy One, blessed be he, told Moses to make the tabernacles, all Israel came along to contribute. Some brought silver, some gold or brass, onyx and stones, kind of very universal, beautiful things. And the women basically come and say, "What have we to contribute?" Now, that's not because they don't also own gold and silver. I think something deeper is going on here. The women say, "Look, it's going to be a very beautiful tabernacle. It's going to have gold and silver and ornaments and rich fabrics and so on. But where are we? Where is our identity? Where is something that represents us and who we are and what we represent?" And they come along and they bring their mirrors and present them to Moses. And the mirrors, of course, representing female identity, their identity in Egypt when they didn't lose hope, the faith they had. And Moses becomes incensed because what he says is eroticism. He sees erotic sexuality, he sees vanity, and he says, "Take their thighs, the symbol of their sexuality, and break them. What use are such mirrors?" And basically God has to come to Moses and say, "Moses, really? What are you talking about, Moses? This is it. This is why I created man and woman. This is what life's about. It's not about enforced celibacy. It's not the life you've chosen. It's about this. These are the mirrors that raised up the hosts. Make them a basin and a stand for the priests in which they can purify themselves," and so on and so forth. And the basin and the laver stand outside of the area in which the priests do their work. In other words, they get to work, and before they go in to bring the sacrifices, they have to wash their hands and feet. The basin and the laver would have been in an area that was accessible to other people as well. And in order to wash your hands and feet, you'd have to look at yourself, right? The idea being that the priests, more than anyone else, have to know who they are before they go to work. They have to, where am I today? Who am I serving? Am I serving God? Am I serving the people? Am I serving myself? Because we know the priesthood can become corrupted. And so the women are saying, this is what's going to be missing. Knowing who you are. What the mirrors allow us to do, yes, obviously vanity and erotic, all those things. But ultimately, it's about identity. And in the tabernacle, more than any other place, when people come, when the priests come to work, but when people come to bring their sacrifices, let them have a mirror so it can reflect back at them who they are and why they're coming to worship in this manner. And God appreciates that. God understands the power here of the metaphor, of the symbol, of the element of identity in self-identity, in worship, national worship, worship of God. And so he says, no, Moshe, you're making a mistake here. You're totally misunderstanding the power of this metaphor, of the mirror, the power of what the mirror represents. And so he encourages Moshe to take it. And so if I go back to, you know, to overall, to kind of wrap it up, I would say it's not surprising when we see how positive these midrashim are, how not just how far the midrash goes in not validating the role of the women, the upholding this kind of very positive femininity, positive sexuality, positive identity, female identity. Then when we go back to the halachic discussions, it seems clear to me that both are working together to create an evening in which women, all our women are important. Women are central. Women are asking the questions. Women are engaging because women were fundamentally those who raised up the hosts and went out of Egypt. And so it's not just the four sons. It's obviously the four daughters, the six daughters, the hundreds of thousands of daughters who continue throughout history to play an important, a central role. And despite the fact that throughout the rest of the year we kind of struggle to define what that role is and how it emerges as the generations go by, at least on Pesach, we can kind of put down, if you will, the struggle and just embrace the inclusion of all of Am Yisrael together, regardless of identity and gender and affiliation, coming together to celebrate this evening of redemption. Thank you very much. And I'm happy.
This is a production of the Pardes Institute of Jewish Studies. For more original Torah content, visit elmad.pardes.org.